Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Mario Ritter, Susan Shand, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
Iran's efforts to influence internet users around the world are larger than experts have thought, reports Reuters news agency. Reuters said that Iran has a group of anonymous websites and social media accounts in 11 important languages. Facebook and other companies said last week that social media accounts and websites were part of an Iranian campaign. The goal was to influence public opinion in other countries. Reuters studied 10 other websites and many accounts on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. The American internet security company FireEye and the Israeli company ClearSky studied Reuters research. The companies said that technical evidence showed a web of sites and social media accounts called the International Union of Virtual Media, or IUVM. Facebook, Twitter, and Alphabet, the parent company of Google, took down some sites and accounts linked to IUVM last week. IUVM spreads information from Iranian state media and other media providers supportive of Iranian policies on the internet. Often the provider makes it difficult to find out where the information came from. Some of these media providers include Iran's Press TV, Fars News Agency, and Al-Manar TV, which is linked to the pro-Iranian militant group Hezbollah in Lebanon. Representatives from those media companies or the Iranian government did not answer Reuters' requests for comments. Since 2016, U.S. officials and media have been looking into possible Russian interference into the presidential election that year. In July, a grand jury in the United States brought charges against 12 Russians. They were accused of being intelligence officers trying to hack computer systems of political groups in 2016. Russia has denied the charges. U.S. officials also have warned that Russia could attempt to influence congressional elections in November. Ben Nimmo is with the Digital Forensic Research Lab at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. He said the Iranian operation was a large-scale one. This shows how easy it is to run an influence operation online, even when the level of skill is low. He said the Iranian operation depended on quantity, not quality, but still stayed secret for years. Facebook spokesman Jay Nancarro said the company is continuing to investigate accounts and pages linked to Iran. The company, he said, took down more pages on Tuesday. I'm Mario Ritter.
Over the years, Tajikistan has taken numerous steps to control the lives of its citizens. The government has rules restricting how long men can grow their beards and the length of women's clothing. It also limits how much food Tajiks are legally permitted to prepare. Now, the government is trying to control how its citizens are memorialized after they die. Tajikistan is restricting the size of markers in the country's burial grounds. News of these restrictions come from an official with the government's Committee on Religious Affairs and Regulation of National Traditions. He spoke with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. The official said that the rule is meant to limit public signs of the wealth of the dead person and his or her family members. The state-controlled Jumhuriyat newspaper first reported on the memorial stone rules in February of 2017. But few people paid attention at that time. But in late August 2018, RFERL published a story about the rules. Now they appear to be the talk of the mostly Muslim country. The Jumhuriyat report said that cemetery stones could be no more than 1.5 meters long, 1 meter wide, and 50 centimeters tall. Abdul Karim Mustafozoda, an official with the government's Religious Affairs Committee, made the announcement. The official who spoke with Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty said the measurements were established by a government declaration. He added that local officials had been told to explain the rule to the public. There is no penalty yet for violating the policy, the official added. Last year, the government announced measures barring people from crying loudly at funerals, a traditional way of mourning in Tajikistan. Officials have also set restrictions on the amount of money families can spend on funerals and other family events. One family in southern Tajikistan last year had food for a wedding party seized by officials who said a wasteful amount had been prepared. I'm Susan Shand.
Lionfish are known for their beauty and unusual look, a common choice for people showing off the colorful creatures in fish tanks. But lionfish are also poisonous, with extremely long and separated spines to carry and shoot poison. The native environment for lionfish includes the South Pacific and Indian Ocean. However, sea experts say lionfish were at some time released into the Atlantic Ocean, likely by people who had kept them in tanks. Lionfish are currently considered a great threat to coral reefs and related sea life in coastal waters of the southeastern United States and Caribbean. Scientists say the fish is a top predator that competes for food and space with native fish in the area. Lionfish kill off and eat many other kinds of fish that are important in helping coral reefs grow and stay healthy. The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, says lionfish reproduce very quickly and are continuing to expand. NOAA scientists predict further reef damage as lionfish keep attacking fish populations already threatened by the effects of climate change, pollution, and overfishing. Now there is a new solution for fighting back. University researchers are developing an underwater robot to hunt down, kill, and collect lionfish. A student-led team at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts developed the robot. The team recently demonstrated the device and is continuing to test and make changes to it. The team says it used machine learning, advanced computer vision libraries, and brain-like networks to develop the robot's vision. It is also equipped to operate underwater without human control. The robot is designed to recognize the lionfish, chase it, and shoot the animal with a spear. The spear then separates from the robot and floats the fish to the surface for collection. Craig Putnam is a computer science professor at Worcester Polytechnic Institute and a director of the school's robotics engineering program. He says the robot was built to simplify the process of hunting down and collecting this aggressive fish. The goal is to be able to toss the robot over the side of a boat and have it go down to the reef, plot out a course, and begin its search, he said. Putnam notes the robot will be required to follow a complex path to avoid the reef, other sea creatures, and people to reach and catch its target. But his team is hopeful the fish-like vehicle can be a part of the environmental solution to limit further damage. Putnam said his team trained the robot system by showing it thousands of images of lionfish in different colors, from many directions, and under different lighting conditions. The robot can correctly identify lionfish about 95% of the time, he added. The head of the university's Robotics Resource Center, Kenneth Stafford, said he is glad the development team was not afraid to take on such a serious environmental problem. This is a real-world problem, and the students attacked it, he said. The team said one of the hardest parts of the project was designing a container for the robot's electronics system. It had to protect it from the harmful effects of salt water. In the coming months, the team will be working to perfect the robot's satellite guidance system. The researchers hope that in addition to helping reduce reef damage, the system can also provide economic help. They say that since lionfish are a popular food item, fishermen could use the robots to safely catch the fish and sell it to local restaurants. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of President George Herbert Walker Bush. He was elected the 41st President of the United States in 1988. George H.W. Bush was president when the Cold War ended between the United States and the Soviet Union. The Cold War had lasted more than 40 years. Both sides were heavily armed with nuclear weapons. People worried that one wrong move could lead to the end of the world. But by the late 1980s, the world was changing. The Soviet Union was dying. On November 9, 1989, East Germany opened the Berlin Wall for the first time since it had been built. The wall had divided communist East Germany from democratic West Germany since 1961. Citizens and soldiers together soon began tearing it down. Tensions continued to ease as communist rule in most of the former Soviet republics ended by the early 1990s. 15 republics had belonged to the Soviet Union. By the end of 1991, most had declared their independence. They became a loosely formed group called the Commonwealth of Independent States. Countries that had considered the United States their enemy now looked to it to lead the way to peace and, they hoped, prosperity. As the Soviet Union was dying, President Bush repeatedly negotiated with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. One of those meetings took place in the spring of 1990 in the United States. It led to an agreement calling for both sides to destroy most of their chemical weapons. The two leaders also agreed to increase trade relations. The American and Soviet presidents met in Moscow in July 1991. There, they signed the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, known as START 1. This treaty called for both sides to reduce their numbers of long-range nuclear weapons. They promised to cut the number by about one-third over 7 years. START 1 became the first agreement between the two powers to order cuts in existing supplies of nuclear weapons. In September 1991, President Bush said the United States would remove most of its short-range nuclear weapons from service. He also said the United States would destroy many of them. The next month, the Soviets announced that they would do the same. On December 25th of that year, Mikhail Gorbachev resigned as president as the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics came to an end.
Compatriots, due to the situation which has evolved as a result of the formation of the Commonwealth of Independent States, I hereby discontinue my activities at the post of President of the USSR.
6 months earlier, Russians had chosen Boris Yeltsin as the first democratically elected leader of Russia. When the Soviet Union collapsed, he became the most important leader of the former republics. President Bush and President Yeltsin signed another Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, START 2, in January 1993.
Fellow citizens, last night I ordered U.S. military forces to Panama. No president takes such action lightly.
One of George Bush's military actions as president was to send troops into Panama in December 1989. They captured the country's leader, General Manuel Noriega. The United States had charged Noriega with drug trafficking. He had also refused to honor election results that showed another candidate winning the presidency. President Bush said he also sent troops to the Central American nation to protect the 35,000 Americans living there. The American troops easily defeated Noriega's forces. He was taken to the United States, where he was tried, found guilty, and sent to prison for many years. The United States then supported the presidency of Guillermo Endara, the winner of the election in Panama.
Five months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined.
In August 1990, Iraq invaded its neighbor, Kuwait. The United Nations Security Council passed a resolution threatening war on Iraq unless it withdrew from Kuwait. The council set a deadline of January 15, 1991. But Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein refused. The United States and other nations were receiving much of their oil from Kuwait and neighboring Saudi Arabia. President Bush succeeded in forming a coalition with 38 other countries against Iraq. The purpose was to free Kuwait and protect Saudi Arabia against a possible Iraqi invasion.
This military action, taken in accord with United Nations resolutions and with the consent of the United States Congress, follows months of constant and virtually endless diplomatic activity on the part of the United Nations, the United States, and many, many other countries. Arab leaders sought what became known as an Arab solution, only to conclude that Saddam Hussein was unwilling to leave Kuwait. Others traveled to Baghdad in a variety of efforts to restore peace and justice. Our Secretary of State, James Baker, held an historic meeting in Geneva, only to be totally rebuffed. This past weekend, in a last-ditch effort, the Secretary General of the United Nations went to the Middle East with peace in his heart, his second such mission, and he came back from Baghdad with no progress at all in getting Saddam Hussein to withdraw from Kuwait.
Coalition forces began an air war against Iraq on January 17, 1991. They bombed Iraqi targets in Iraq and Kuwait. On February 23rd, the Iraqis set fire to hundreds of Kuwaiti oil wells.
It looks like what I envisioned hell would look like. The country of Kuwait is burning.
The coalition had the long and difficult task of putting those fires out. On February 24th, the Allied ground war began as part of the operation known as Desert Storm. That ground war lasted just 100 hours. Saddam Hussein withdrew his forces from Kuwait, but he was still in control of his own country. Years later, some Americans continued to criticize the Bush administration for not trying to oust the Iraqi leader. They believe that Bush should have sent forces to capture Baghdad, the Iraqi capital. After the war ended, Kurds in northern Iraq rebelled against Saddam Hussein. So did Shiite Muslims in southern Iraq. The Iraqi government crushed both uprisings. The defeated Kurds fled to Iran and Turkey and into the mountains of northern Iraq. President Bush ordered American troops to help give humanitarian aid to the refugees. The troops established refugee camps for the Kurds. As time passed, Iraqi soldiers and aircraft continued to attack the Kurds in the north and the Shiites in the south. Coalition forces led by the United States established no-fly zones barring Iraqi aircraft over northern and southern Iraq. Coalition planes enforced these no-fly zones in the years that followed. By late 1992, drought and conflict had caused widespread suffering in Somalia.
I want to talk to you today about the tragedy in Somalia and about a mission that can ease suffering and save lives. Every American has seen the shocking images from Somalia. The scope of suffering there is hard to imagine. Already, over 250,000 people have died in the Somali famine. In the months ahead, five times that number, 1.5 million people could starve to death.
The violence and the collapse of the government were keeping many Somalis from receiving food and other aid.
The security situation has grown worse. The UN has been prevented from deploying its initial commitment of troops. In many cases, food from relief flights is being looted upon landing. Food convoys have been hijacked, aid workers assaulted, ships with food have been subject to artillery attacks that prevented them from docking. There is no government in Somalia. Law and order have broken down. Anarchy prevails. One image tells the story. Imagine 7,000 tons of food aid literally bursting out of a warehouse on a dock in Mogadishu while Somalis starve less than a kilometer away because relief workers cannot run the gauntlet of armed gangs roving the city.
President Bush, in the last year of his term, sent American troops to Somalia to assist in the aid efforts. But the following year, in October of 1993, 18 American soldiers on a raid were killed in a battle in Mogadishu. More than 80 others were wounded. That failed operation would haunt the American military for years to come. The events of that day were the basis for the book and movie Black Hawk Down. In December of 1992, as Bush was about to leave office, he and the leaders of Canada and Mexico signed the North American Free Trade Agreement. NAFTA called for removing taxes and other barriers to trade in North America. Some Americans accused Bush of sacrificing American jobs to lower-paid workers in Mexico by supporting NAFTA. Others praised him for supporting the agreement, which still had to pass Congress. But by the time it did, George Bush was no longer president. He had lost his campaign for a second term. In November of 1992, he lost the election to the Democratic governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.